Vredelijke Chanukah to one and all, ladies and gentlemen. Second night of Chanukah. We enjoyed the delicious desserts from the famous Kollel kitchen. And we have with us tonight to share some words, l'kavod l'chag, l'kavod this wonderful festival, the Festival of Lights. Lasts for 8 days. For 8 days, we're to think about praising Hashem. We're to think about thanking Hashem. We're to think about the Rabbim Biyad Ma'atim, Giborim Biyad Chaloshim. They're the ones who are victorious. The more we realize how weak we are, the more we realize how few we are, and indeed all the might and all the greatness is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we'll be victorious as well. So it's certainly nice to have Rabbi Yerachmiel Milstein, currently a Rav in Lakewood of Congregation Isha Yisrael, who has spoken many hundreds of times to different audiences, Project Chazon, Project Inspire. I understand that quite a multifaceted and talented person. And without further ado, we'd like to ask Rabbi Milstein to inspire.
Thank you very, very much. I want to tell you, it was a little traumatic getting here because I drove to the wrong part of town. And it was horrible. It was traumatic. I was traumatized. I looked up and I looked around and it looked like Brooklyn. It's a pleasure to be here finally. And yes, B'ez Hashem, we will talk about Chanukah. You know, many of us have Chanukah miracles that take place in our own homes. I don't know if you're aware of that. They make latkes and you eat them and they burn for 8 days. You heard that one already? No, you know? Okay, just... But we'll talk about a real Chanukah miracle. So as the rabbi, thank you very much. Thank you for introducing me. As the rabbi said, in the prayer that we add for Chanukah, B'mei Matisyahu, we talk about the fantastic miracle that occurred. It was a phenomenal miracle. And primarily, if you read the B'mei Matisyahu, it's a military miracle. It's really quite a military miracle. And Rabin Biyad Ma'atim, I just want to put that in perspective. Many were delivered in the hands of the few. Many. The Greeks, who conquered the entire known world, in the hands of the few, a couple of hundred of the Maccabees. Let's just put this in perspective. This is not some small, you know, contest that took place, and one side's a little bigger than the other, and this one's got the weight advantage, or this one has the tank advantage, this one has the missile advantage. He's talking about a military that conquered the known world, that's defeated by a ragged group of soldiers who don't know how to soldier. They don't know how to be an army. I mean, the miracle is really, really tremendous. So we thank Hashem, Rabban Biyad Miatim, but then we say Tmei Biyad Tahirim. The impure were delivered into the hands of the pure. Now, I don't know about you, but nice guys finish last. It's not always true. Sometimes the pure can also be militarily superior. So why is that a quality that we bring up there? Rishoyim Biyad Tzadikim, the evil in the hands of the righteous. I know we like to think of people walk around, you know, carrying all different armaments and guns, you know, bad people, if you meet them in the neighborhood I just was. But on a military, you know, to feel, I mean, you know, okay, so maybe there's good guys out there. They're tzaddikim, they're righteous people who are just more talented militarily. So where's the miracle in that? Like, what is that about? So I think we have to recognize really what we're talking about here is there's a lot of symbolism. There's a menorah that we light. And the menorah that we light exemplifies, or actually publicizes, the miracle. It's called Persuma Nisa, to publicize the great miracle that happened. And therefore we light this menorah, we take this menorah, we put it in a window, I guess because it's very celebratory, it's very public, and we want to advertise it, and therefore you put it in your window. Right? You put it in your window, that people should see it. On the other hand, however, there seems to be a contradictory halacha there, in that you can only put one wick per cup. Because you have two wicks in a cup, that's too big. That's called already an avuka, that's called a torch. That's not really a menorah. Wait a second. Is this a public thing or private? If it's a public thing, Right? What's the big deal? To put a Twix inside of it. You're putting it in the window because it's a public thing. It's a private thing. Then why do you put it in the window for? Like, it has to be so small that you can hardly see it. Then why do you put it in your window? Like, what's going on with the menorah? It seems to be a contradiction. On the one hand, we make it public. On the other hand, it's got to be, like, kind of modest and small. Like, what is this about? Let's understand something about what took place thousands of years ago. And that is, the war that took place was not a war on a battlefield alone, but there was a war of ideals. There was a war of self-definition. There was a war of philosophy that took place. The mighty Greeks were a people who really, really had, for the first time, an intellectual capacity and an intellectual development that was, on some levels, on a par with the Jews. You know, the Jews, we have been universally literate for thousands of years. I just want to give you a point of reference. The United States of America, was an article in the New York Times just a few months ago, the country is functionally illiterate at the rate of 35%. New York Times, a few months ago, right? 50 years ago, 50% of the country was illiterate in the United States of America. We were universally literate. We were a very, very enlightened people for a long, long time. We didn't find many kindred spirits among the Gentiles. Because the Gentiles, and even, by the way, the Greeks, who already were intellectually they were developed, certainly intellectually. But even there, you could only vote in the plebiscite if you knew how to read. So it was a very small percentage of people who voted, because the vast majority of the country still could not read. But nonetheless, that there was any percentage at all that could read and that was intellectual, that were people of letters, was quite impressive. And it was very alluring now for certain Jews who thought until that point we had the monopoly on intellectual development, and now suddenly there's another people coming along and they have intellect. And, you know, they have literature, they have sciences, mathematics. There are many, many different practical science or applied sciences that they had. So it was very alluring for a lot of Jews to buy into that, because now there was something that you could study that wasn't Jewish as well. It didn't really exist that much before. So it's kind of interesting as to what happened. And a lot of Jews bought into it. But even though they were a rather sophisticated society as compared to the rest of the world, let's remember what the Greeks stood for. The Greeks stood for physicality for the sake of physicality. What you see is what you get. If you can't study it, you don't understand it, it does not exist. It's the physical world is the be-all and the end-all of existence. That's what the Greeks believed. So therefore, if I'm living in a world that's completely physical, then I am going to indulge in the completely physical, even if it means that I have to take someone out in order to reach my physical goal. If you have a pleasure that you own, and I want that pleasure, and if I'm bigger than you, I simply get you out of the way and I take what I want. Summed up in three words, might makes right. If the entire world is only purely a physical world and there's nothing else, then anything that I want, and if there's someone in the way and I happen to be more powerful, I apply the law of the jungle. Adolf Hitler, Yamach Shemo, wrote about this in Mein Kampf. He was feeling terribly for himself that the Jews gave this world this blemish called conscience. And he's really missing the time when human beings acted like pure animals, barbarians. He loves the title, he loves being called a barbarian. He says, we are proud of the title. Yes, we are barbarians, and we're proud of being barbarians. Because like the animals in the jungle, if a bear crushes a baby cub to death, do they take it to court? Is it held accountable? Is there a moral judgment applied? Certainly not. He said about the Aryans, we're the same way, we're superior, and therefore we go out and we take what we want. He's feeling badly. He misses the good old days. This is Greece. When you take this to an absolute level, what you have is that human life therefore has no inherent meaningfulness other than the pleasure you can take from it, other than purely physical. Which is why you have human beings who are literally being torn to shreds on a regular basis in a place called the Colosseum, a place of culture. The Colosseum, the contests that were held there, were between either humans and humans to the death, most barbaric death possible, humans against animals. And most of the humans that were there, or many of the humans that were used for these contests and for the purpose of entertainment, they were people with certain defects. People who are born without the proper height, or they didn't look right. People who are simply considered to be inferior were thrown in for no fault of their own. They could have been innocent people. It made absolutely no difference. They would literally rip each other to shreds. If you don't think about the Colosseum had fountains. The fountains were, by any perspective, I mean, they were miraculously engineered. The engineering that they possessed at that time was quite sophisticated. And the fountains were able to spray in a very, very sophisticated way. Patterns and all different kinds of things. The fountains were very sophisticated. But does anyone know what the fountain sprayed? People think they sprayed water. When you go visit the ruins, it did not spray water. It did not spray blood either. No, it did spray, you ready? Perfume. Why did it spray perfume? Because people would come to the Colosseum, as I said before, and I kid you, not for entertainment. Some people today would go to, you know, watch and go to the circus, or they go to a sports event. So the sports event they would go to would be people killing each other. And when you would come to those sports events, they didn't hawk in those days, popcorn, popcorn, get your beer. They didn't do that in those days. So you had to bring your own lunch from home. You had to brown bag it, so to speak. But people would eat at these things. You went out, you had like a picnic. People are killing each other, and you had a picnic. But the stench of blood was so overwhelming that people would gag. So that's why, you see, they sprayed perfume. Now this is the other great culture from which we inherit so much. Just go to downtown Philadelphia, look at the architecture. We didn't invent it, we got it from them. The plebiscite, wow, wow, what great people they are. This is the most sophisticated culture of the period. Why? How could sophisticated people think that way? Because it's physical for the sake of physical alone. The human body was worshipped because of its perfection. What if the human body did not have perfection? What if a baby, Chalila, was born with a birth defect? It was taken to a particular part of town where it was left to be, a very polite word, exposed. They allowed the child to be on the outside, whether it would die from the sun, starvation, or cold, and they would leave the children to die. Exposure. Exposure. Exposure was the way that they disposed of children that they didn't really, really want. Even if a child was born perfectly, by the way, but it couldn't be supported properly because it was infringing upon the needs of the existing family and there wasn't enough food to go around, the child would be exposed. How many of you remember, should excuse me, the rabbis, but I know this, Spock saying something about the needs of the many supersede the needs of the few? Anybody remember that? The guys remember that, right? Right. That comes from Greece, by the way. And that was the justification to expose their children, kill their own children. Because the family already existed. They're here already. Now you got this new kid over here. You know, he's infringing upon the rights of the many because I don't have enough to feed them now. And therefore, all you do is you do away with that child. Which great Greek philosopher spoke out against the practice of exposure? You're all absolutely correct. Thank you for knowing the right answer. Nobody. Socrates defended it. Aristotle defended it. They all defended it. They said it was correct. Because the needs of the many. The needs of the many. Like, come on, needs of the few. We don't understand this today because we're living in a society that's already so far removed, that has been so influenced by, yes, Judaic values. Thank God. We haven't gotten the job really done yet. There's a ways to go. Right? But we have Judaized in some way society because there are certain concepts that we stood for that are the exact opposite of what the Greeks stood for. And even though the Greek architecture is still pervasive today, but thank God some of those philosophies are gone. The concept we call charity. What does charity mean? When someone is weaker than I am, then I don't go out and conquer him, but what I do is I go out and I try to support him. That's a Jewish concept. In the good old days, the bad old days, if you had an enemy, a neighboring country that was suffering famine, you didn't go do a telethon and raise money for them. What you do was you conquered. You used the opportunity to go in and conquer them and take them out because they were weak and they couldn't possibly put up an effective defense. We said might does not make responsibility. Might does not make right. Might makes responsibility. Might does not make right. Might makes responsibility. If I'm stronger, I'm meant to take care of someone who's somewhat weaker. The concept of charity that we taught the world, by the way, halachically, does not only apply to Jews. The Jews are committed to supporting the indigent, even if they're not Jewish. Now, if you have a certain limited amount of money, and your brother's hurting, your cousin's hurting, you should hopefully support your brother first. If your cousin's hurting, a stranger's hurting, you support your cousin first. We understand that. But there's no question that we have an obligation to everybody. They're great stories of some of the greatest Gedolim who went ahead and they interceded on behalf of people who are Gentiles, even anti-Semites. It's a strange type of story. The sons are of, there was an illegitimate child in a community, whatever it was, and he used to feed this kid. They found out later, he used to feed this beggar on the street, who everyone knew he was a tremendous anti-Semite, the son of an anti-Semite. He used to feed him, he says, Ezrecha Mensch, he's also a human being. It's incredible that we taught the world certain concepts that we take for granted now. We don't recognize that we are the authors of these concepts. This is who we are as people. The concept of universal education comes from us. We call it a university today. Universities today, I don't know if you notice, are not so universal. If you have the right marks or the right influence, or the right background, the right amount of money to pay the tuition today, if it happens to be a private college, you're not getting in there. But we as Jews, we educate all of our people, everybody, regardless of financial ability, regardless of anything. We go ahead and we have the Rambam tells us, just reflecting the Talmud, that we all have a universal obligation to educate our young. And if a child doesn't have a father who can make sure that happens, then the grandfather's do it. If the grandfather can't do it, then the Beit Din, the local court, administers it. There's no such thing as someone not getting it. We taught that to the world. Public schools that you have in the United States of America, which reflects this value, to a large extent comes from us. Other societies, certainly in antiquity, they didn't want to have an educated population. Then it'd be harder to subjugate. People are smart, start asking questions, the next thing you know, right? So this is a Jewish concept. This is, we're at war with the Greeks. To use children to entertain yourself, which is what they did in those days. I don't want to go into details, because it's not sneeze to talk about these things. We consider that to be a crime. But that was nearly universal in those days. That's what the Greeks stood for. The Greeks stood for physicality, for the sake of physicality. It was not a means to any kind of an end. Life is what you saw. Life is what you enjoyed. Life is how you pleasured yourself. That's what life was all about. We all know the old eat, drink, and be merry, right? You know, we tell a Jew, tomorrow you may die. You know, the Jew says, he does tshuva right away. He doesn't eat, drink, be merry. He gets nervous. He does Rosh Hashanah. He does Yom Kippur. He has a fast day, right? They have a field day. Tomorrow you may die. Okay, you know, right? The philosophy is a totally opposite philosophy. It's a completely different philosophy. The Greek respects nature and nature alone. If you can't study it and analyze it, you can't figure out how it works, then you're not interested in it. So Rav Hirsch tells us that the Hebrew name for Greece really personifies exactly this point. It's composed of three letters, a Yud, a Vav, and a Nun. And if you look at them, each one is simply a line, and each succeeding letter is just an extension of the previous one. It's called Teva, nature. Nature develops, nature moves on. That's all it is. It's point A, which becomes point B, point C. That's all there is really in life, and that's really what the Greeks are all about. They're very limited to the world of the physical, and there's nothing else there. But we have a completely different understanding of what life is about. We understand that life is about using the physical that we have to elevate ourselves so we can transcend our own physicality and we can reach out and at some point be able to kiviyachol make contact with, touch, realize the spiritual. Every one of us has an ability on some level to be godlike. The halachta bedrachav. You can go in the ways of God. Every one of us can be godlike. We can transform who we are by our actions. We can be selfless. We can be people who are very generous. We can be people who are sensitive and aware of what's going on around us. We can be people who can sympathize and empathize. We have the ability to be extremely godlike. That's what the Jews are about. The Jews are about caring for other people. And by the way, when even you see Jews who really are not traditional Jews and they have no connection to the organized religion that we call, even when they don't have no connection to that, you find Jews to be amazing, amazing people. I've traveled the length and breadth of this country many, many times. And wherever you go, you meet Jews. And when you meet these Jews, it's very interesting. You ask them, what do you do when these people have been assimilated for three generations? And this one volunteers in an AIDS clinic, and this one serves soup in a soup kitchen when they come after 10 hours at work every day, and this one's the president of the ASPCA, and this one heads up the recycling commission. I'm not saying I agree with all their causes, but these are good people. It's in our genes. Every Jew knows, every Jew understands, that to have means to share. It's a universal among the Jewish people. To have is to share. Which country in the world to this day gives the most charity per capita? It's Israel. People don't know that. Israel gives more charity per capita than any other country in the world. for many years, the Jewish community in South Africa was the most charitable community, according to ancient old JNF figures, which someone shared with me when I was in South Africa. That this tiny little community there, they gave as much money as countries that were much, much bigger than they were. Jews are an incredible people. We're incredible about taking care of each other. We're incredibly generous. We're incredibly open-hearted. That's what Jews are about. It's all about looking at what you've got in life, taking stock. And if you've got an extra article of clothing and you put it in a box and you give it away to someone else, it makes you feel good. That gives you pleasure. If you have an extra dollar in your pocket, you understand it's meant to share with someone who has no dollars in his pocket. If you have an extra morsel of food, you give it away to someone who has nothing to eat. This is who we are as a people. If you have a little extra good cheer in your life, then find someone who needs a little extra and you cheer them up. You spend the time to cheer them up. It's an incredible thing. The most happy, well-adjusted people sometimes I find in Judaism are people who hang around disease all the time. The Bikur Cholim people, people go visit people in the hospitals. It's amazing. You've got to watch these people. They light up a room when they walk in. These people are so talented, so wonderful, so terrific. And they understand what they need to do with it. And it makes them feel so realized and so fulfilled. Realizing their potential. This is who we are. This is what gives us pleasure. The physical world is something that you use in order to bootstrap yourself to a higher place in life, to transcend the limitations of this physical life, and to be godlike. This is what we believe in. The physical world is best paradigmed in an olive. Let me explain to you why. Back in the farm that I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, we didn't have an olive orchard, right? But if you think about it, an olive is the perfect fruit. The olive, the fruit of the olive, is delicious, especially on pizza. It's delicious. As a kid, I didn't like olives. They were too sour. I can't get enough of olives now. Olives, like, it's just delicious. It's a great, it's unique taste. It's very flavorful. It's very robust. It gets a zing. It gives you a little zing to it, right? They're terrific. Olive, the meat of the olive is delicious. What about the juice of the olive? Olive oil. Olive oil is absolutely magnificent. It's great. How many doctors in the room? No doctors in the room? Okay, what does it do for your cholesterol? Olive oil? It lowers it, that's right. Olive oil is good for you. Olive oil is good for you. Yes, it does. It actually does. It lowers your lipids, and it raises your good cholesterol and puts down your bad cholesterol. Right. So, it's incredible. It's very, very healthy. It has medicinal purposes. In fact, olive oil, for years and years and years, all by itself, was used as some kind of a healing salve. People used to use it. Olive oil was very, very used. By the way, as a cosmetic, olive oil is tremendous. Even today, go to your local drugstore, look at the shampoos, how many of them say, made with real olive oil? Right? Who would have thought of that? It's very, very good for you. By the way, as a moisturizer, it works very well too. Your hands will smell a little funny, it's true. But to get over that, it's a terrific thing. Olive oil is absolutely fantastic. It's cosmetic, it's medicine, it's a salve. Excellent, terrific, terrific. What about the pit of the olive? How many of you know what self-lighting charcoal briquettes are? What? Self-lighting charcoal briquettes. You know what those are? Those are briquettes that smell really, really foul because they're soaked with lighter fluid. So when you put it on your barbecue, if you still have the old-fashioned ones, you don't have the gas because you're too cheap to get the gas canister. We know people like that, you and I, right? 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 So you light it and it lights on its own. You know the first self-lighting briquettes were olive pits. Olive pits are soaked in oil. They're soaking with oil. And yet it's very, very, it's a dense wood-like substance. It burns forever. You didn't know that, right? And the peel of the olive. The peel of the olive. In ancient times, when we didn't have the ovens and the furnaces that we have today, so to keep your food warm on Shabbos, you had to insulate it. So there's a whole perek in the tractate called Shabbos, Bamet Toinen. And what do you insulate things? One of the things that was considered a very, very high quality insulation was remetz. What's remetz? Olive peel. That's what it is. It was very, very insulating. It is a complete fruit that is completely useful. It is completely efficient. There's no waste to it. It's the perfect fruit, and therefore it represents the best of this world. The olive represents, it's so terrific that Israel is praised by being Eretz Zeis Shemen. It's a land that flows with the oil of the olive. The olive is considered a terrific. Therefore, it comes to symbolize Olam Hazeh, or the physical. In almost every society, whether modern or ancient, fire usually has some spiritual connotation. Think about it. Think about all those terrible movies you saw when you were young, and they had these black candles with flames, and it's very spooky, right? Everything's very spooky, right? Well, it's true, because fire, it's kind of physical, but it's also not. I mean, you can really feel it, at least the temperature, but you can't feel it because it has no substance to it. So it's here and it's not here. It's kind of like the spiritual, right? Spiritual, you can warm yourself with it just like fire, or you get burnt with it just like fire. Got to be careful. Okay? So fire is the symbol of spirituality in just about every society, whether ancient or modern. That's what fire is. So we light, you see, a menorah. And lighting the menorah is all about demonstrating to the world what Hanukkah is all about. Yes, there was a military victory, but no, there is no military parade, because that's not what we were fighting over. We were not fighting over territory the way militaries ordinarily do. We're fighting over the concept. We're fighting over life. We're fighting over the meaning of life. And therefore, what we do with the menorah is we simply take the Olam Hazeh, the physical, and we transform it into the spiritual. And that message is very important. And you don't want that message getting lost. And if you have two wicks in a cup, it might come to look like a torch, it might come to look like you're trying to illuminate your room. And suddenly people don't realize that you're lighting the menorah for the pure symbolism. I don't know if you know about this, but the Gentiles have a holiday that come out December 25th. You know about that? Yeah. And a lot of good Christians are complaining today that the meaning has left the holiday. Because you get these vast, huge lights out there. And vast, huge sales out there. And Black Fridays and Cyber Mondays and I don't know what they call Tuesdays. Twilight 2 days, I don't know what they call it, right? Wacky Wednesdays. Thrilling Thursdays. You come right back to the Fridays, right? It's incredible. It's incredible. And people complain, like, where's the meaning of this? You see, because a message can be drowned out by its messenger. When the messenger overpowers the message, then you've defeated your purpose, if you're trying to deliver a message. It's very important that the message that we have remain what it's supposed to be, which is the symbol of the olive oil being transformed into the flame. And if you somehow add an extra wick to it, and it becomes a little too big, the message gets lost. And therefore, yes, you do stick it in your window, because that message is something that we proclaim to the world. But you've got to keep it just so, because you don't want the messenger to overwhelm the message. But there's a little more here. What do we call the medium that's used that transforms the oil into light? It's called a wick. You have the medium. How do you say a wick in Hebrew? Pesila or petila, right? Pesila. Okay. If olive oil personifies physical creation in terms of inanimate objects, what is the most superior animate object on the planet? Hope there aren't any animal rights people here at this moment. But if you're an animal rights person, right? What's the greatest animate object? And that has to be a human being. The human being, too, we're able to transform ourselves. We're able to take whatever physical blessings we have. We're able to use every opportunity that we're given by the Almighty to transform it in the service of the Almighty, and thereby get to be like God. We get to be the Sula Mutza Varza. We are produced by nature. It's true. We're produced in the same way that cows are produced. We're physical in some way. But we have the ability, we have the neshama, we have the soul that allows us to climb that ladder and go all the way up, and like Jacob's ladder, the Hine Hashem Nitzav Olav, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is standing over him. We can come to the point where we recognize that God is standing over us every single moment. It's Mutzav Arza, it's supported by the ground, don't get me wrong. If you don't have the physical ability, then you don't have the challenges that each and every one of us needs to become spiritual. because it is those challenges, those very challenges that frustrate us sometimes, that get in the way of our lives, that really turns us into spiritual people. You see, we have a life script that's handed to us from God that we don't get to pick. You can work with it, you can run away from it, but you don't get to pick it. And it is those challenges precisely that transforms us from the purely physical into the spiritual. And those challenges might be a learning disability. The challenge could be a physical disability. The challenge could be a psychological disability. Many challenges out there. Life ain't easy. There are problems. And everybody's got their bundle. You know, being a first-generation American, you know, my parents were Holocaust survivors, you know, we grew up with this understanding that life doesn't always pan out the way you want it to pan out. Maybe, therefore, some of us expected less out of life. Maybe we're able to be a little happier with it. Maybe. But everybody has challenges. There's no such thing as a human being who doesn't have challenges. The people who don't have challenges, they live in small plots and they're pushing up daisies. They have no challenges anymore. To be alive means to have challenges. That's what it means. We as human beings, yes, we live in a physical world. We're produced by the forces of nature that produces the animal world. Yes, that's true. But we have this amazing capacity to be able to relate to the Almighty. There's this interface that we possess that turns us from the purely physical and helps us transcend the physical limitation that we have and creates in us people who are like angels. And just as the olive oil needs a medium, for us to transform ourselves as human beings into the angels we can become, we require a medium. And the medium is the same as the wick, meaning it has the same letters. The wick is called pitila or pisila, and what transforms us into spiritual beings is called tifila. It's not only the same gematria or numerical value, it's the exact same letters. It's just rearranged. We have an ability to interface kaviyachol with the Almighty. We were created for that. That's who we are. And everything that we have in life, everything that comes our way, is meant to have a higher purpose in life. I mean, you have to wonder about the Jews. We've had so many failures in life. I was once doing a discovery seminar many, many years ago. A gentleman comes over to me and says, "Rabbi Milstein, I don't understand how you can still pound the pavement this way. Don't you realize it's over?" I said, "What's over?" He said, "Come on, I mean, this campaign to get people spiritual and into their Judaism, come on, look at the overwhelming rates of assimilation out there. We're winning a battle here, but we're losing the fight." He says, "And if you look at history, it's the way it's always been, you know? For 2,000 years, the rabbis are telling us, do the right thing, we'll build a temple. So if you haven't gotten it right after 2,000 years, you know, you're not getting it right anymore." Very defeatist message. So I said, "Sir, I feel very badly for you. Because I naively think that there's tremendous meaning in my life. That despite that there are many obstacles out there, I get to go out and I get to do what I do. Once you enjoy the effort, it never feels like work. I can never get defeated. If the effort is enjoyable, because the effort itself is truly the meaning of life. The meaning of life is not to arrive at a certain point. Yes, we'll get there, God willing. We'll get there. The Mashiach is going to come. We're going to build a base of Mikdash. We're going to dance together, Mitzvah Shev, all of us together here, right? We're all going to go to Eretz Yisrael. It's going to be great. There's no question, right? But that's not what I'm doing at this moment. What I'm doing at this moment is fighting to get there. And it's a glorious, magnificent battle. And every single moment has tremendous meaning. You see, I feel bad for those ancient Greeks because they didn't understand how beautiful it is to look at someone else in the morning and give them a big smile for no good reason and just say good morning. Our Mishnah tells us that every person should greet each other. How? B'sefer Parim Yavetz, a big smile on your face. Do you know what happens when I do that? I become a little more like God. I feel bad for those ancient Greeks. They'll never understand the pure pleasure of Mrs. Kramer, the holy woman from Jerusalem. If you read the story, fantastic story about this woman, Holocaust survivor, was not able to establish her own biological family, so she raised a whole bunch of kids who were special needs children, and she's interviewed by this writer who had been a Hindu. She was Jewish, but she was part of a ashram for many, many years. And she meets this lady, and they told her this is the happiest lady you're ever going to want to meet. And she meets this lady, the lady's dressed in little more than rags, and she lives in a hovel, which hasn't been painted in 20 years in Israel, has an earthen floor, doesn't even have a tile floor, and she goes out, and she's giving away everything she has to other people. She looks at her, she says, how could you be happy? She says, life is great, she says. Yeah, but what about the Holocaust? Mrs. Kramer says, the Holocaust wasn't so bad. Says, what? Says, yeah, because even in the Holocaust, as meager as your rations were, you could still break it in half and give a little to someone else. Rav Nosson C. Finkel, the late Rosh Yeshiva of Mir Yeshiva, entertained a group of billionaires, among them Howard Schultz of Starbucks fame. And he afterwards wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times describing his meeting with the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir Yeshiva. Rosh Yeshiva was ill for many years. He could not control his bodily movements. He just couldn't control himself. It was a great effort for him to speak. When he would start speaking, it was just in a whisper until he got up the strength to be able to get the words out. And, forgive me, his appearance was, at some point, although he was a very good-looking man, was kind of grotesque. It was difficult. Those of us who knew him and loved him for many, many years, every time I'd come to Israel again and get that big beer hug from him, it was more and more difficult to look at him. And he's obviously suffering. So he's in the room with this group of billionaires, Jewish billionaires. And everyone's averting their eyes from him. And at some point he says, look at me, because I need to ask you a question. So they look at him. And he says, what lesson did you take from the Holocaust? One guy says, I don't know, never again. He said, wrong. Another guy said, anti-Semitism? Wrong. And then he looked at him and he said, do you know when they processed Jews to become inmates of those infamous concentration camps? They take like five guys and assign them a bunk, and the sixth one on that bunk, and if you've seen those bunks, you saw how narrow they are, six people had to sleep on them. When one turned in the middle of the night, they all had to turn, otherwise they would fall off, right? The sixth guy got a blanket. That's all there was. It was one blanket for six people. The rabbi said, you know, every single person in the camp who got a blanket had a choice. How much do I pull to myself and how much do I push over to the other guy? He said, the lesson of the Holocaust is there's always an opportunity to give. That's what we stand for. We can always give to someone else. The Greeks stood for, there's always an opportunity to take. And if someone's in the way, and they're weaker than you, then just enjoy beating them up too in the process. We stood for, there's always an opportunity to take care of. There's always an opportunity for spirituality. In everything that we do in life, there's always an opportunity for spirituality. Yes, saying good morning has unbelievable and unlimited meaning. Helping out the impoverished has unbelievable and unlimited meaning. Being good to your spouse has unbelievable and unlimited meaning. Teaching your children your values, unbelievable and unlimited meaning. Life has unbelievable and unlimited meaning, even when we don't see it or understand it. Because every one of us, it's all about that menorah. It's about that little menorah that exists. I want to tell you about an amazing story that I heard, which I checked it on the internet because I wanted to make sure it was true. It's true anyway. How many of you right now in your house, in your houses, in your homes, possess a box of colored Hanukkah candles? Raise your hands. And on how many of that boxes is the box primarily blue, and it's got this logo that says menorah on it, menorah candles, made in Israel? Nobody? You have one? How many of you get the candles from Tel Yeshiva? Okay, that's where it comes from. Now we know. Okay. The largest candle company in the world that does Hanukkah candles is the menorah candle company. They produce millions and millions and millions and millions of candles. They're the largest in the world. They're located in a city called Sderot in Israel. That's where the factory is in Sderot. Let me tell you about this company. There was a small menorah manufacturing company that existed in Israel and started producing candles. And then you see, there was a Jew who made Aliyah to Israel from France at the age of 65, approximately 22 years ago. He's 87 years old right now. And he bought the company at that time. And he, being a billionaire, brilliant businessman that he was, he built the company up, built the company up, until it employs, I think, I forget what percentage, a very large percentage of labor force in Sderot. And why in Sderot? Because they're always being attacked because they're near Gaza. That's why he wanted to give them more and more jobs. And it was always his dream to produce candles. Because, you see, he came from a small town in Poland. And when the Nazis invaded, his family ran into the woods and they hid out during the war. And the children had to be especially quiet. And they couldn't play loud games. They couldn't do much of anything because they were always afraid that the Nazis would kill them. So when the first Hanukkah came, they had no celebration. They didn't light anything. They didn't do it. There was no celebration for Hanukkah. The second Hanukkah, when this fellow, this now philanthropist, was all of, I believe, 9 years old, he said, "We cannot have Hanukkah without a celebration." But they said, "You can't celebrate. You can't light anything. They'll see the flames. We'll be dead." So he went ahead and he had a crayon, and he took a piece of wood, and he drew a menorah on a block of wood. And on the first night, he drew one flame, and the whole family stood around, and they lit the menorah. And on the second night, they did the second, same through the whole. And with that, he restored to his family a sense of celebration of Hanukkah. And he swore to himself, if he'd ever survive, he wanted to provide candles to the entire world. And he survived. This man, who went through that Nazi Holocaust experience, who lost most of his relatives, who watched people die before his eyes when he was 9 and 10 years old, who could have had a nightmare of a life, is one of the most happy people in the world. He's 77 years old. I think this story is 2 years old. He's probably 89 by now. But they say he's still alive, and he's one of the happiest because he continues to give and give and give. He is the Hanukkah story. Every one of us could be the Hanukkah story. And when we dedicate ourselves, and when we do what we really, really need to do, even when the odds are overwhelming, but if this is what we're doing, we're taking the physical and transforming it into the spiritual, I think the lesson of Hanukkah is you can't lose. The Maccabees were 200. The Greeks were, I don't know, hundreds of thousands. But this is the message. This is what you're trying to do. You can't lose. Even when you don't seem to be winning, even when you don't see victory in your sights, even when you can't figure life out and say, why is this happening to me? But if during that time you just keep going and you transform the physical to the spiritual, your life has unbelievable and unlimited meaning. And that is the primary message of Hanukkah. That our lives are extraordinarily meaningful. We can take a little bit of oil and light up the world. We can do a little bit of charity and change someone's universe. We become partners with the Almighty and His universe by doing the work that He designates for us to do. God can and does create perfection. It's called a snowflake. A snowflake is perfection. You stick it under the microscope, it is absolute perfection. And there are billions of them that will fall on a single block during a snowstorm. And no two are alike. And every one of them is perfect. If God wants to make things perfect, boy, can He do things perfectly. And yet when it comes to human beings, there are some out there who have extra money, and there are some who don't have enough. So why does God do that? Because that's the meaning of life. The world is designed to be a place where we can have tremendous meaning. Our input is as important as the cosmos itself, because it's the purpose of the cosmos. That's what Hanukkah is all about. So when you light your candles on the Hanukkah menorah, this is not some ancient ceremony that we do because that's the way it's been done in our family for generations, although that's a pretty good reason. It's not something we do because it's the festival of lights, and that gives us excuses to give our kids different presents every single night of Hanukkah. And it's not something that we do in order to ingest a whole bunch of calories that we don't really, really need, only to have to diet them off for the rest of the year. That's not what it's about. But what it is about is to remind us not to go through life practicing the things we practice out of rote or habit, but to recognize the inherent meaningfulness of every single action we take. Think, focus, remember, we are not the same as the Gentiles. That's not who we are. We've had a tremendous influence on them, but we're not the same as Gentiles. Because everything that we do has purpose. Everything that we do has meaning. Except maybe watching football on Super Sunday. Everything that we do has absolute and inherent meaning. So go out, do what we need to do. Once we spread the light enough, then we go back to the pre-Adam days, where the light that exists in the world was purely spiritual. And when that happens, all of our problems, all of our issues, all the challenges go by the wayside. And we're zochi, you and I, together to live in the time of Mashiach, the Meher V'Yameinu. Amen. Thank you so much for listening.
One of the secrets that Rabbi Milstein hasn't shared with us is one of the reasons why he's able to be so happy is because he could inspire people in many different ways. Rabbi Milstein is extremely talented and will share a couple songs with us. Rabbi Milstein sings professionally on some tapes.
You're going to have to sing.
Oh, CDs. Oh, your voice is shot.
Voice is shot. But we'll,
okay, we'll sing. You'll play. Rabbi Milstein will play. We'll have a little Kumsitz here. Please enjoy the refreshments. Meyer will be at 5 to 10. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Have a Freilich Hanukkah.